All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true!
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
All mapped out. How maps shape us. It's been described as a provocative and surprising study of maps and mapping in this journey. We're going to encounter maps scratched onto rocks and materializing on plasma screens made of words and sound, and even maps meant to be seen by the eyes of self-driving cars rather than humans. It's the new book by Mike Duggan. Delighted to say that Mike joins us live on the line. Mike, good morning to you.
Hi, Charles. Nice to be here.
Nice to see you too. And whereabouts? You don't have to give me a grid reference, but whereabouts are you this morning?
I'm in Norfolk on holiday, actually.
Very nice too. So, maps. Well, I mean, I'm of a generation that grew up doing orienteering and map reading and, you know, cadet force and all that sort of stuff. And one might argue that the art of map reading has gone straight out the window because now we just talk to our smartphones.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true for many people. And I think you'd struggle to find, you know, many Gen Z with good map reading skills in the same way that older generations might do. But I think there is also, you know, somewhat of a backlash to the digital map. So people more interested in kind of disengaging with our digital world and society and kind of learning those skills again, navigation skills. It's certainly something which, you know, Ordnance Survey are aware of. So they're producing more kind of paper maps than they have done over the last 20 years because there's this kind of new generation of people that are interested in kind of experimenting with, you know, non-digital mapping services for sure.
So what's your background and what got you sort of interested in writing? Because it's not a love letter, it's not an ode to the Ordnance Survey, is it?
No, not at all. No. So I'm my training's in cultural geography, so it's a kind of subdiscipline of human geography.
Cultural geography, right, Mike? Stop you there. What is cultural geography? Come on, tell me.
Good question.
Yeah.
So I would explain it as a kind of mix of kind of sociology and anthropology, but thinking about different spaces and places. So I guess a good example would be you're in Marbella, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thinking about the English-speaking community in Marbella, how does that work alongside the Spanish-speaking community? What's the history of that? What's the kind of new cultural directions of that? All these kinds of questions. This was what I'm kind of trained in.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. So that's the background. And so you're looking at maps from a cultural geography perspective rather than just a valley and this is a gully sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm absolutely rubbish at rocks and hills and stuff. I'm much more interested in people and how they use maps. So I don't make any maps myself. I'm interested in, you know, how you and I, for example, might use Google Maps in slightly different ways, or how different cultures appropriate map use in different ways.
So where do we start off then? Because, I mean, if you think, you talk to people about maps, okay, they'll think about Ordnance Survey and then they'll start going off on tangents and think, hang on a second, X marks the spot, treasure maps, and there be dragons, of course. And I'm sitting to you, you know, sitting in a studio not so far from Gibraltar, Pillars of Hercules. That was the end of the world. That's what one point, of course.
Yeah, so it's maps have a place in people's lives in quite specific ways and also culturally specific ways. I think if you think about the UK context, so growing up in the UK, you're kind of taught to use Ordnance Survey maps at school, but also there's this kind of maps associated with fantasy novels, with storytelling. They're all over, you know, kids' films and young adult films. And so I think we see them as part of they're kind of in the background of our everyday activities, but they're always there, you know, in the stories that we read, in how we get to places. And once you start looking at, you know, where maps are and how people use them, you begin to see these. It's quite, you know, nuanced ways in which people associate themselves with them. And not all about just getting from A to B. They can mean quite a lot to people. So, you know, my earliest memories of maps are things like opening the first pages of the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit, right? And the map's there to kind of guide you through the story. Yeah,
absolutely. I was about to say that because it, you know, you would open a book like Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, and you think, okay, so this is where we're going to go. And you know, but people like us, shall we say, Mike, they may call us nerds, but we're not. We, you know, we'd go back and find out exactly where they were in Minas Tirith or wherever they were going to be exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same thing with, you know, Indiana Jones films, maps are kind of the way in which the story is told, how they get the characters from one place to another place is to use that map overlay. So fantasy and storytelling are certainly a big part of map culture.
And so where do we find the first sort of maps cropping up? Because, I mean, every culture needs them. And if you are in as a member of the ancients, I suppose these are unexplored territories. A lot of this is very, very frightening because culture is storytelling. If you can't explain it, that means the imagination can go quite wild. And you see those great sort of Renaissance things of rhinos who seem to have tortoises on their back, tortoise shells, and one-eyed Bigfoot men, you know, living in, I don't know, South Croydon or something like that. And, you know, and but those sort of, so you need a map to keep trade routes open, to make sure that you don't cross into territory and you don't get snatched by some horrendous nasty that's living just past those rocks over yonder.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's, you know, as long as humans have been around, they've been inscribing things about the things around them on stuff. So, you know, rocks or in the sand or on, you know, walls of caves, etc. You often find these inscriptions of specific things which are important to the cultures around them. So I guess, you know, earliest forms of map making would be rock carvings. And there's a long history of that in Europe. It's called a cup and ring map. So they kind of don't really look like maps at all as we might understand them today. They're kind of these carvings where there's a kind of cup in the middle and then these rings around the outside. And archaeologists have recognized those as a kind of primitive form of map because they tell us something about the landscape in front of them. Usually it's kind of agricultural points of interest. So, you know, you can grow certain things there. Okay. And therefore the rock here. But the way in which we understand maps today through kind of grid lines and referencing systems, coordinates, I think it's a bit of an error sometimes to kind of map that image of a map onto these historical kind of rock carvings because they're kind of produced in very different contexts. And part of one of the chapters in the book is all about this. You know, how do we understand maps of the past is not necessarily a great idea to take our understanding of today and kind of put that onto the past.
Because what you're just saying with the cup and the cup and ring one, that's not just saying how to get from A to B, you know, get from Thor's cave to Tharg's cave. That's saying you can grow this crop on this area. It's a guide, yeah. Right? It's a guide rather than, so it's not in a direction thing, it's an environment thing.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. So, you know, navigational maps aren't particularly old. You know, people didn't use maps to get from A to B because they didn't really travel that far. It would be a very select group of people that did that, whether, you know, mariners or kind of messengers, but the everyday person wouldn't travel too far from where they live. So they wouldn't need this kind of navigational map, whereas they may be much more interested in maps which told them about their environment, as you say, the things around them. So farmers, for example, or people that had an understanding of, or, you know, local authorities who wanted to understand who owned what in what bits of the area.
And I suppose the other thing is, if you get to, should we leap forward a bit in time? Let's do, you know, the time travel thing. If you're looking at the 1500s, the time of empires, and I'm thinking Portugal, Spain, yep. England, you know, but, you know, having map reading skills or getting a map designed or made or cartographed or however you want to call it is a sign of prestige for your merchant fleet. But blimey, it's a thing of power because look, we own, and this is the British used to have, you know, the British Empire used to be, what is it, one fifth of the world used to be pink bits. But back in the sort of the 16th, 15th centuries, you can say, behold my, you know, my chattels, my vassals and the lands that I have.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this association with maps and power goes back a long time, but mostly to this period you're talking about where, you know, colonial empires were sending people out to produce maps, not only to document the territories which they, you know, discovered, but really to say, these are the territories which we discovered, and therefore they are ours now because we've mapped them. And you could argue that kind of continues today in some respects or another, but it's important to remember that who makes maps is the important question to ask, not necessarily what the map shows. So, you know, you could argue that Google today is a kind of, you know, new form of this kind of colonizer in terms of the mapping that it does. But there's lots of really great work on, for example, the positioning of world maps and how that really emerged from this kind of 1500 period onwards. So, you know, if we look at a map today, usually Europe's in the middle.
Yep.
And this is an association with Europe being the kind of center of world power at that time. Whereas if you go to other parts of the world and look at world maps, often Europe's not at the center of that world because it's not at the center of their world, for example. Even in the States, there's, you know, many examples of public school maps where the US is in the center rather than Europe.
Yes, strange that. I just had a thought because I am, you know, as the audience will be groaning now, but you know, I'm that worst sort of creature, an armchair historian, and the old saying is history is always written by the winners. I'd never thought of this before when I just had this conversation with you, Mike. But maps are drawn and they're obviously going to put themselves at the center of the known world because they wish to show their importance and, you know, and say, look at us, we are the main player.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if we bring this up today, so thinking about Google Maps today and the battle they have with, I guess their competitors are Apple Maps or Here Maps. And, you know, what they're trying to do is dominate the space in order to say that, you know, we are the ones with the power to show you the best or most accurate representations of the world. And along with that comes a bunch of politics. So, you know, if we look at, politically tense regions around the world, so China and Taiwan, for example, on Google Maps, if you look at it in the UK, I'm sure it's the same in Spain, there'll be a kind of dotted line between Taiwan and China. Taiwan will be labeled as Taiwan. China will be labeled as Taiwan. China, whereas if you go on to China's mapping service, you won't see that distinction, right? Taiwan won't even be named as a separate island. It will be named as a kind of part of mainland China. And the same thing with, you know, Russia and Ukraine and the Crimea when the war broke out in 2022. Google and Apple both changed how they represented that border between Crimea and Russia to say that actually it was part of Ukraine, not part of Russia. And this shows us, you know, where the politics of these companies are, which is largely kind of, you know, Washington-based view of the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nuances of that, of course, are manifold. I'm just thinking as well about the prestige of that period of quote unquote colonial exploration in the sort of, especially with relates to the British Empire, but also the Belgians as well in Africa. And there must have been, you know, they were going out to map the unconquered territory in the same way that the Arctic and the Antarctic explorers were going out to map unconquered territory. So there was this huge prestige to be seen in actually getting out there and doing it itself. That's why we have, you know, it's the Royal Geographic Society, for example.
Yeah, and I think it's quite easy to look back now and say that it was all about a power grab. It was all about domination. But I think there's also, you know, the birth and the emergence of science as a professional discipline, this kind of age of exploration, age of discovery, people wanting to find out new ways of understanding the world. And I think it's all kind of, you know, packaged up together in map making. So you may have had, you know, a king or royal court ordering a map to be produced by a bunch of, you know, mariners, but also tied up in that you've got individuals wanting to kind of, you know, progress the kind of discipline of cartography or to think about new surveying methods. And you could argue, you know, they're not doing it for the same reasons that the king has ordered the map to be produced for. It's a bit like, again, today with Google. I think it's wrong to say everyone that works for Google Maps is kind of out there to produce this kind of, you know, map of domination. Really, they're just doing their jobs, trying to advance the kind of school of cartography.
So where do you see, you know, where do you see us at the moment in terms of electronic smartphone map? Because people say, oh, well, nobody's going to need a phone in the future. We're not going to need televisions. We're not going to need newspapers. And we're not going to use maps because everything's on the end of our phone. But, you know, we do need maps. We do. What if everything goes down suddenly? You know, there's going to be a lot of Generation Zs wandering around going, I can't cope. I need a safe space. And they won't be able to find a safe space because they won't be able to read a map. But joking aside, it is a life skill. And also there is something in the same way that people read a newspaper, isn't there is something tangible and there is something distinctly romantic and tactile about thinking I want to go somewhere, and rather just keying in what the algorithm says you deserve a holiday in X and Y and Z, to look at a map and go, hang on, you know, what's that place, you know, where can we go from here? And you know, when you, McGregor and Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman went around the world famously the first time around, they didn't just key into Google Maps, give me a quick route across the world.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. It's, there's a skill there which is not just about getting from A to B. It's about how, you know, connecting ourselves to the things around us or to the earth itself. And you could argue that if you're typing in an address into Google Maps, it's telling you how long it's going to get there. It's going to give you some directions, but it's not giving you that same kind of personal connection to the environment around you. Maybe, maybe not. I would agree with you. Like it's a life skill which has importance beyond just kind of practicalities, right? It's about, you know, being in the world, seeing things, engaging with things, finding new, interesting new things about places. I think there perhaps should be more emphasis on kind of teaching this skill or developing this skill, in, for example, in schools.
And even in the 21st century world, in a capital such as London, there's still a map that everybody refers to every day if you are a commuter in London. But you may not regard it as a map because it has become so insidious into your getting around London that it's almost a piece of work and it's a go-to. And I'm talking, of course, about the best map in the world, which is easy to understand, which is the London Underground map.
Yeah, it's a fantastic example, and it really shines a light on where we are with the kind of analog and digital. So I live in London, use the tube every day. It's interesting to see how often it still gets referred to by both, you know, tourists and locals.
Yeah.
So on the station platform, it's often the map which people gather around and they use their fingers to trace the routes. And on the trains themselves, it's often directly in your eye line. So, you know, people in London don't look at each other on the train. They look at the map or the adverts above them. And it's often much easier to do that than kind of fiddle around with your phone, kind of zooming in and out, because it's quite a large map. So it really suggests that, you know, that this idea of the analog map, the paper map, the laminated map is not gone. It has its use value, particularly in kind of transit systems. And the same kind of thing can be said in New York as well. You know, the transit map is everywhere. It has its place.
The only problem I ever got with the London Tube map was when I first moved to London in whenever. I thought the spaces between the tube stations were real time. So I assumed that where I was going to look for a new place, you know, as an 18-year-old moving to the Big Smoke, was only going to be 5 minutes from Covent Garden, and I ended up in Finchley, which was slightly longer away than it was, but there you go.
That famous example, I think the one that gets often quoted is the distance between Covent Garden and Leicester Square. You know, it's like a 5 minute walk, but on the many people get the train because they think it's longer than that, because it kind of suggests it might be.
What's your favorite map, sort of your favorite map and your favorite story behind the map, as it were?
Yeah, good question. I like the maps that are really large that you can walk on. And I think this is from being a kid watching This Morning. You know, they used to have these
maps. Oh, the guy leaping. Yeah.
And there's quite a few of those around the world. There's one in up in Peebles, in Scotland, Peebles Castle. And then there's an even larger one, I can't remember, somewhere in Italy. And the idea of walking on the map is quite an interesting phenomena, because it's almost like you are, you know, on the territory in which the map is supposed to represent, whereas other maps are much more kind of condensed. I also have, you know, fond memories of the guy, the weatherman, falling off the maps in full dock.
Was it Fred something? Was it Fred?
Yeah, I forgot his name.
Yeah.
But they used to send him out there in all weathers, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. What's you hoping that people will learn from All Mapped Out?
So I'm hoping it kind of shines a light on, like we're talking about, maps aren't just about navigation. They're not just about these kind of objective views of the world. They're much more of a kind of social and cultural object, which find our ways into our lives in kind of quite interesting ways, and not just these kind of practical ways. So it's trying to bring some academic ideas that aren't really discussed in the public realm very much. So it's basically my attempt at translation. So, you know, many people were interested in maps. There are many, many books about maps, but they tend to be these kind of coffee table books which show, you know, I don't know, 100 most important maps or 10 maps that's changed the world or something like that. Whereas my approach is saying, I'm not really interested in the map itself. I'm interested in how does it affect you and your life, and how does it affect those in, you know, around you. So that's the kind of the aim, I suppose. A good example I always try to bring it into the personal realm. So one example I've been using recently is tracking apps, and the way in which people are kind of putting location trackers on their teenage children, for example. You know, where are they going?
Yeah.
What are they up to? And it's this interesting. So maps are the interface of this kind of relationship, which is, you know, it's been around forever, but it provides a new way to understand our relationship to our children and our relationship to our parents. And it's interesting how it kind of, it, you know, straddles this border between surveillance and care. You know, if you can see where your children are you caring for them, or are you being surveillance on them? That kind of
thing. As the godfather to several teenage girls, trust me, that is invaluable. Because, you know, because find my little darling app is invaluable. But one skill that we can see, you may lament the lack of old-fashioned maps, but you see, Generation Zers will never know the tense standoff that would come between your parents when they were trying to map read in the car, and you'd be in this. I'm a little bit older than you are, Mike, but you know, you'd be sitting in the back of the BMW, and there'd be this horrendous silence as they'd realise somebody got the map reading wrong, and there was no turning back, and you'd have to go another 5 miles up the M6.
Yeah, that's a really good example. It's a bit in the book where I talk about my own experiences with that exact same thing, driving around northern France with my parents while they shouted and argued over the map, going around, you know, multiple roundabouts. I think that it's some, you know, exists in some respect. So this idea that, you know, navigation with others is a social activity, and those that you're around have an effect on how the activity is going to play out. So if you're with someone that you know is a good navigator, even with a digital map, you kind of give them that role in the activity. Whereas if you're with a bunch of strangers, that's a work trip or something, or, you know, after work drinks, trying to find the bar, and there's a bit more tension between, you know, who is given that role and how that role plays out. So this idea of social navigation is something I'm also trying to develop in the book as well.
The book is called All Mapped Out, How Maps Share Us. It's by Mike Duggan, who we're speaking to today. Mike, if people want to find you, Tish Boom, online, and they don't want to go to a map, you see what I'm just dropping all the cliches in while I can, my friend. Well, where's the best place to locate you on the social media or on a media?
I guess on X or Twitter. So it's at Mike Duggan 4. Number 4.
The book is called All Mapped Out, How Maps Shape Us. It's by Mike Duggan. You can also order it via our own virtual bookstore. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thanks, Charles. Pleasure. Cheers.